The scripture reading this morning comes from the book of Judges, chapter 1, verses 11 through 15, and chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "I will give my daughter Aksah in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer." Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to him in marriage. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What can I do for you?" She replied, "Do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water." Then Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherahs. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. But when they cried out to the Lord, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years, until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. This is the word of the Lord.
Yeah, let's give him a hand first. Yeah, let's give him a hand for those names. It was a pretty formidable guy. That guy is actually not, we don't know who he was historically. It could be a number of historical figures there, but Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, was a formidable foe, not only for Sean, but also for Othniel. Okay. Why do we get married?
Why get married? That's what I want to talk to you about today. I want to talk to you
about marriage.
And I wonder if we could put this on sideways. Okay. If you're single,
why might you get married? If you're married, why are you married? What is it that's going on there? And people tend to think, when you think about marriage, people tend to think of it as a way to make themselves happy. This is a way to find happiness by getting married. But I want to encourage you to think about marriage in a different way. Think about marriage as the power to accomplish something in the world, to make the world into something. Because when you look at a decision about married, single in the Bible, you know, that's more often what it's about. It's about the call of God on your life. What should you be doing? And does marriage hinder that, or does marriage help that in what you're doing? So if you think about marriage, it's a little bit of a different way to think about, you know, why to get married, if to get married, what you're doing when you are married. Doesn't mean that your happiness in marriage is unimportant. It's contentment in marriage and a stability in marriage that comes from that contentment upon which great deeds are built. So marriage is, the contentment is important, because when a husband and wife are happy together, when they're content, they're with one another, they function as a team, and big things happen. Okay, so here's the thing. For the past 150 years, marriage has been in decline as an institution. New divorces per 1,000 people has steadily risen, while the rate of people getting married is now lower than it's ever been, going back to 1860. And so people who actually are familiar with this data and look at it have been getting concerned over the years. And there have been little ups and downs, but the trend is pretty steady. And people who look into this have spent a lot of research, time, and money on trying to figure out what makes a marriage relationship stable. What is it that makes for a good, long-lasting marriage? They've poured a lot into this because people who are looking at this and are concerned want to know what it is that makes a good, long-lasting marriage. And if you look at all the studies that have been done on this closely, you see that intimacy in a marriage is a big key. Whether intimacy is achieved in the marriage. And I'm not just talking about physical intimacy. I mean, especially emotional intimacy in the marriage. Okay, well, that's interesting. But what promotes intimacy then in marriage? What builds intimacy between two people? Trust, companionship, sharing, these different aspects that kind of bring people together in a bond that doesn't get broken. What does that? And the modern researchers and writers who are thinking about this and trying to do research into this today think that, for the large part, marriage should be updated. The problem is there are certain things that have been in marriage traditionally that have probably interfering with people coming together and being intimate. And one of the targets is kind of gender differentiation and the ways in which traditionally, especially, you know, in kind of religious, conservative religious or Christian marriages, you know, there's this gender thing going on where the husband is the head of the wife and they don't divide roles equally, and they, you know, there's a decision-making, you know, distance there, incongruity. And so they're saying that's probably why things are going down in marriage. That needs to be updated. And so many writers and scholars have theorized that egalitarian marriages are what we should go for to try to repair the health of marriage. Make sense? Now, egalitarian marriage, when I say that, I mean marriages that consciously seek to suppress gender distinction in responsibilities in the marriage relationship. That, you know, don't try to make a difference in terms of decision making. It should all be 50-50 in terms of what you do and your responsibilities to each other in the relationship. They're all the same. And just trying to get kind of a gender difference out of it. That's an egalitarian marriage. And so people theorize, many contemporary family scholars argue that if you have egalitarian marriages, that should result in greater intimacy and therefore high quality, stable marriages. Now, why is this supposed to happen? Here's the theory. The idea is that some writers argue that when you have an ideology of husbandly authority or wifely deferral, those kinds of things, that's been traditional, you know, in Christian marriages especially, that creates a climate of male domination and female subservience. And so it ends up discouraging intimacy because men are not expressive with their wives. And in the worst case, it promotes domestic violence. You know, whereas if you kind of eliminate patriarchal authority, you remove social distance, and that promotes intimacy. Okay, you could see how that might be true. That's the theory. That would be the first reason. The second reason is that if married people are doing common tasks, they're both doing the same things, then, you know, there's kind of more shared experiences. And so there'll be a mutual understanding that's cultivated through that. And thirdly, the reason this is they argue this works is that egalitarian-minded men who are kind of open to just things being all this equal in a marriage relationship, they tend to be, the idea is, how do I put this, open to a counter-stereotypical masculinity. I can put it that way. That is that they're not concerned with being macho, and so they're more open about their feelings. They're not thinking they have to be masculine in a certain way, and that should remove social distance, and so there'll be closeness. So you see, it kind of makes sense. These things could be so. That's the theory. And so for these reasons, egalitarian marriages are predicted to be characterized by more interpersonal closeness and trust and communication, mutuality, those kinds of things. But in fact, my friends, studies on marriage contentment do not bear that out. In fact, Well, first of all, research that's been done, and a lot of research now has been done, first of all, the research that's been done indicates no connection at all between conservative Christians and domestic violence. There's not a real connection there between the two, or any kind of religious person and domestic violence. There's no correlation there in the data. As well, kind of more importantly, there's a lack of connection between egalitarian marriages and marital happiness in what we see so far. So it suggests that this is maybe not the way that we should be going to try to repair the institution of marriage and make it stronger and make long-lasting marriages. And one study found, I think this was N.A. Greeley, found in his data that religious wives and husbands who embrace what the study called gender role traditionalism is what he called it, are much more likely to have high marital quality and much less likely to get divorced. It was kind of startling find, actually, that the feeling, what this researcher found, is the feeling of being made important by the spouse was a more powerful contributor to marital happiness than even a sense of equality in a marriage. So it's an odd finding in these results. And to quote Brad Wilcox and Stephen Nock, researchers who do this a lot, look at this situation a lot, quote, "It appears that women in marriages characterized by more traditional gender beliefs and practices are happier," unquote. It's odd, you know. And this link is not well explored, but it's suggesting that marriages that have an asymmetry to them somehow work better. There seems to be a higher contentment there. Now, precisely why that is, from the husband's side, is what my doctoral dissertation is all about. So I want to thank you, Village Church, for your support over this year and a half that I'm taking in making that part of my pastoral work to you, looking at just a small part of the reason why that might be so. But what it seems to suggest is that there's something to this gender thing, that what we would say is a gift to us, the gift of gender. There's something in that that builds powerful relationships, that builds long-lasting, stable, intimate relationships. Something in it. Now, friends, when we turn to look at the scriptures, we actually find that very thing. And we can see it here in this one of these initial stories in the book of Judges, in these passages that we read about Othniel, the first judge. And so what I want to do is look at this and see what this can tell us about romance in the kingdom of heaven. We read here verses 11 through 15 of chapter 1. And here they are again for you to look at. I just, first thing to note about this is that this is a repeat. These verses are a repeat, word for word, from the book of Joshua. Okay? So it's an earlier book in the Bible, and if you go back to Joshua 15, verses 15 through 19, you find these very same words. Not anything changed, word for word. It's just a repeat of what you find in Joshua. So what is the author doing here? The author isn't giving us anything new in these verses. So why is he, or she, whoever the author is, why in this book is the author repeating these verses in the book? It doesn't seem to add something to what's going on in the narrative of chapter 1. And if the author wants to kind of make a point, this is part of Judah's victories, could have summarized it in some way, but it's not. It's a word-for-word repeat, and this extra information about this marriage, this kind of daring marriage that was that came together in the process of taking this town. Well, I think I know why, friends, the author did this. And it is because the author is wants to contrast the first judge with the last judge. Remember a couple weeks ago how I argued that the entire book of Judges is a chiasm. We went over that chiasm. That's the first idea or the object, or first item matches the last item. Second item matches second last item, third to last, right? And I was trying to show how the whole book, actually, in the handout that I gave you, is one giant chiasm. Well, when we look at that chiasm, we find that the first judge, Othniel, matches up in many ways with the last judge, Samson. And if we take these two and move them together, so to speak, and compare them, what do we find? We find that Othniel was a Kenizzite proselyte, not an ethnic Israelite. Samson was an ethnic Israelite. Okay? Yet Samson marries a Philistine woman. He has an affair with a Philistine harlot, and then he loves another Philistine woman, Delilah. She is his undoing. You remember that story, right? Othniel seeks and marries an Israelite wife, has extreme success, and ends up in bliss in his life, accomplishing great things for God. And the message is pretty obvious, friends. The wife is the key. The wife is the key to these men's success or their failure. The wives are key. So the implied lesson here to the audience, the author is trying to say, is pay very close attention to who you marry. You should marry people who are going to be going along the same lines with you inside the people of God. You should not marry outside the people of God. And they were not to do that. They were not to marry people outside the faith community that was working all together to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. And that was what the covenant community was trying to do. Now, when I say that, I just want to make it clear that this has nothing to do with race. This isn't a matter of racism. You know, don't marry, you know, someone who doesn't come from your ethnicity or your skin color. It's nothing like that. Because, you know, if there were a Philistine or foreign woman that did want God's kingdom to come and wanted to go in that direction, that would be fine. In fact, that is what happened with a woman named Rahab in a town called Jericho before this. So this is not about racism, it's about purity in serving God's purposes. It's noteworthy that Othniel himself is not an Israelite, that he's a Kenizzite, and his clan got associated with the tribe of Judah, so he was kind of became an Israelite, but he's not an Israelite himself. So this isn't about race, it's about marrying within faith commitments. So what this is showing us, what the author is showing us, is really a recognition that there's a powerful influence of a spouse on one's faith and one's direction over time. Right? So we can make right away a kind of pretty easy application of this. For Christians, this is why you should not get romantically involved with someone who cannot share your faith commitments. You shouldn't be getting romantically involved with non-believers. And again, it's not talking about cultural differences or racial differences, you know, because those certainly provide obstacles in relationships, but if you're into it and you want to attack those obstacles, it can be a beautiful thing. interracial marriage, intercultural marriage. If you're that kind of person and you can overcome those obstacles and go along with living with a certain amount of discomfort in just the differences that those things provide, that's great. What we're talking about here is marrying those who can't share the deepest part of you, which is your faith. Right? And I know that when I say that, sometimes the reaction I get is, oh my gosh, how can you say that? It so limits the playing field. Right? And that might be true. Your playing field gets limited. But do you realize the effect over the years that marrying outside your faith commitments is going to have? And what you'll be able to do in your life and what you won't be able to do. Do you realize that? You know, we used to have a family in this church who were our poster family for this argument, because they got married both as non-believers, and then one of them converted. And so they worked things out. They were cooperative. But whenever we had young people in the church who kind of started to get involved romantically with non-believers, we would always send that person to this couple to talk to them and to listen to them talk about their relationship and what a strain it was and pain that was involved in not being able to share a fundamental worldview. You know, I'm not talking about differences in doctrine or different denominations. I'm talking about whether or not you base your life on Jesus Christ. So we'd always send the folks over. They would talk to both of them, the husband and the wife, and they would say what it would be like what that life would really be like. So the point is here, friends, that Othniel does not intermarry with the Canaanites, even though he might have reason to, because ethnically he's not an Israelite. But Samson, who has no reason to, nonetheless does. So the goal for Samson, you know, is just finding a spouse. It's pretty unrelated to God. It was simply, I want what I want. Othniel saw a much higher purpose to marriage. Consequently, his life was much more powerful in what it accomplished in the purposes of God, and much greater contentment. It was to promulgate the kingdom of heaven. So what I want to do with you is take a few minutes and look at the contrast. This is what the author is doing for us. I want to look at the contrast between Othniel and Samson to teach us what a husband gets from a godly wife. What a husband gets from a wife who's going along that same direction and out for God's purposes. So even though this is about, you know, ostensibly this is about Othniel, really it's about Oxa. It's really much more about what Oxa does that affects Othniel's life. So it's a little bit unbalanced, the sermon today. I'm really going to be addressing women because I think this is what the passage brings us to. So let's take a look at this, how that half of a powerful marriage works. Three things that a godly wife gives to her husband. Three things you do for love. Okay. The first thing is in verses 12 through 13 in our first passage in chapter 1. She gives the incentive. She gives the incentive. Samson's wives provided incentive for him to live among the Philistines. You can go and read that story. You see Samson's constantly going down, living among the Philistines. So his kind of girl provided the incentive to live among the Philistines. And they drive his life spiritually. His Philistine woman just drives him spiritually. Othniel's wife provides the incentive here as well, but the incentive is to drive out the Canaanites to further the purposes of God. Now, when you read these verses 12 and 13, got to keep working on that color. If you can. Caleb said, I give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. And Othniel stands up, rises to the charge and does it. Now, you read something like that, it sounds a little bit like a fairy tale, doesn't it? The knight goes forward and does this quest in order to win the hand of the princess. Sounds a lot like a fairy tale, doesn't it? And that would be dismissed today as untenable, right? Because we've moved beyond that. But friends, here's what I think the Bible would tell us, is that there are some things about this that you don't move beyond. That there's something in the gift of gender that men for women are inspired to do things, great deeds for God in the world. And it's in a different way than women for men. That this is how it works. She was the prize. She was the prize. And what you actually find, friends, is that for a wife, a man rises to heights that he would not otherwise do. And that is the way it happens. Guys change when they are inspired, when they are motivated by a wife. And if you take away that distinctive, a man oftentimes loses motivation. Now, this is true intensely in marriage. It's also true outside of marriage. You know, if you have a group of guys moving a piano, if there's a group of women watching them, they'll do a much better job. I've seen it. And the man changes for her. You know, it's funny how this happens, but often a man changes in his motivation and his character for a woman. The Apostle Paul notes this in the New Testament when he's talking about the value of singleness. He says, you know, being married is good, but actually being single is better, because when you get married, you're divided. It's inescapable that you're divided in your interests, and it becomes all about pleasing a wife. And so, you know, that's why he's saying, you know, think carefully about whether it's better to be married or to be single. Of course, in this case, what's great, in some cases it works out, if the wife's purposes are devoted to the Lord herself, then it can work if the husband then becomes devoted to the Lord in a greater way. In some cases, a man is motivated to God's purposes in his life by the promise of his wife. And I would suggest to you the Bible's wisdom in this. It really does match real life. And I would also suggest that egalitarian marriages kind of miss this. People also say that, you know, you could get this with the same gendered marriage. You have marriages that are between two people of the same gender, a guy and a guy, or a woman and a woman. But those that I've talked to who've experienced both long-term same-gendered relationships and also long-term transgendered, what I call transgendered relationships across the genders, they say that there's something different about what a wife provides as far as an incentive to pursue. There's something that different that's brought out of them because it calls them to change in a way that a same-gendered relationship does not. Because of the challenge in confronting the other, she gives the incentive. That's one. Two, she not only gives the incentive, the faithful wife also gives the pressing. The pressing. Now, when we look at Samson, we find that his wives, you remember that story, they pressed him. His wife pressed him to reveal his secrets. To his undoing. Well, Othniel's wife presses him as well. But her pressing is to ask her father for a valuable inheritance. Now, there are two ways you can read this. You can read that and see what Aksa did, you know, urging and urging. And you could look at it and say, man, she's being overbearing. She's being pushy. Or, you know, you could say she's properly pressing. You know? And if you're a wife, you know that this is often the question that you're asking yourself. Is it not? Am I nagging him? Am I nagging him? Or am I properly pressing him? Am I properly raising my voice to him? Or am I nagging? That's, you know, it could go either way. So how should we read this? Well, I think because of the literary clue, friends, of Oxa's contrast to Delilah that we're given, that what the author is doing is lifting up Oxa and telling us, here's an example to follow, that this is a good thing. And what that teaches us is that in this godly marriage, the godly wife is not passive. She's not passive. Okay, she presses more than her guy's shirts. And so when we start talking about an asymmetry in marriage, as sometimes it is sometimes misunderstood. And that and when you have an asymmetry in your marriage, in the relationship, it doesn't mean that a wife's voice is not heard. It doesn't mean that you don't make your voice heard if you're a wife. The godly wife raises her voice with her husband. She doesn't raise her voice for power. Oxa is not raising her voice to gain power in the relationship. But she's raising her voice to promote God's purposes, as we'll see. Very important ingredient here to what makes a powerful marriage on the earth. Now, I could give you a lot of examples from my wife of how she has pressed me. You know, she's a great example of pressing, but she presses in a soft and respectful way that allows me to go through changes for God. Remember, early in our marriage, when we got married, I was living under a different name. I had gone through a name change for different reasons. And it was kind of a big issue. My wife began to press me about how this was actually a problem in my father's family, that I had assumed a different name. And she, through her pressing, her respectful and consistent pressing, it began to be unfolded for me. Something, a big change in my life that resulted in a reconciliation that needed to happen between myself and my father. So I can look at that and really see the need for the wife in my life to raise her voice and how her pressing of me really allowed me to come to a new place, a very powerful place of doing things for God in the world. She gives the pressing. She gives the incentive. Number three, friends, verse 15. She makes a home. She makes a home. Again, Samson's wives destroy him. Samson's wife ends up leaving him without any home at all, except a dungeon. In contrast here, Othniel's wife secures land for him, good land for him. And this land, the Negev, land in the Negev means, you know, that's what kind of what the word means. It's a deserty land. So you might use the land for different things, but if you're going to live on this land, you need water. Access to water in places like that in Israel mean the difference between being able to live there or not live there. It's the difference between being uninhabitable and being habitable. If you're going to try to live there. And that is what Oxa wants to do. She wants to take this land gift. She wants to live on it. In other words, friends, she's practically concerned with making the home work, with getting what is needed to sustain the covenant family that they would have. She's trying to build up the covenant community by establishing a family in the land. And to do that, she needed water. And so she makes a request of her father. Caleb gives her the upper and lower springs. It's a merism, meaning all the water in the area. So you see what's going on? She did what she could to make a home out of the dry land. She's pressing her husband for things he might not see. She's not complaining about living in the Negev. She's not, you don't see Isaac coming out and say, oh man, live in this Negev, no water, blah, blah. She's not complaining. She's practical. She's shrewd. She's resourceful. She improvises. You know, there's an opportunity here when she comes to her father, and she's not meddling, because she has a relationship with her father, whom she just left to be joined with her husband. And her father asks her what she wants, so she takes the opportunity and says, give me the springs. So you see, I think, a wonderful picture here of how the godly wife provides a home, makes a home, works for a home. And you know, this improvisation that needs to go on, it tells us that there are many different kinds of situations that you could have. I mean, I know these days a lot of different economic situations. And what I counsel women who are getting married, the most important thing in their heart is to have this attitude in their heart, regardless of how it plays out, is that this is what your drive, your goal should be: to make a home for him, to establish yourself, to do God's purposes. So we had a couple in this church a little while ago, for example, kind of a different situation, because of a medical condition that he had, he could not, it was very limited in the work that he could do. So the way that their things were working out for them is that she had this kind of main job, and he was working on things to try to supplement that, but she had the main job. There was only a limited amount that she could do at home. But I saw a wonderful picture of the way in which she was taking care of him, creating a home for him, because in this job that she went to each day, and it was difficult for her, she got this dental care, this wonderful dental coverage. And through the dental coverage, they were able to fix his teeth. He had a lot wrong with his teeth, and she was able he was able to get his teeth fixed. And I just saw this bringing health into his life as a kind of application of this in a different kind of circumstance. So different ways to do it, but she gives him a home. She makes a home. Okay, those are the three things. What are the results? That's why I think the author included the passage from chapter 1, so that when we read the passage from chapter 3, we would know what was behind it. Because in this first judge, it's not only the first judge, he's kind of the model judge. This is the passage that begins the cycle of judges in the book, after the first two introductions. And what do we read in verse 10? The Spirit of the Lord was upon him. The Spirit of the Lord was upon Othniel. Now, do you think that is unrelated to what I've just been talking about? I suggest to you it is not. I suggest that the author repeats the Joshua passage because Achsah was the important detail of Othniel being who he was. This Spirit-empowered career is the result of Achsah in his life. As I said, we're not sure who this king of Aram is, but where he's coming from is over by Mesopotamia. If he's coming all the way over from Mesopotamia to the land of Israel, this is probably the most powerful enemy that's confronted in the book. If he has that kind of a reach, probably the most powerful enemy is this guy that Othniel faces. So this is somewhat understated that, you know, his hand prevailed against this guy. It stated rather simply, but it was an extraordinary accomplishment for Othniel to give the land rest from this foe. And their land, verse 11, had rest for 40 years, a generation, because of the stalwart leadership provided by a man who had stability in his life, who had motivation, who had pressing from the other, who had a home. You can contrast that again with Samson. Samson inflicts casualties on the Philistines, but he doesn't deliver the nation from a foreign power. You know, the nation never once follows him into battle. Othniel here goes to war. The nation never follows Samson into battle. So what do you see here is Othniel had the life that allowed him to take responsibility for the covenant community, the whole covenant community, in a big way. Bear responsibility for others. Mark that, friends. That's what success is in God's eyes. So we see the overall message here isn't so much about Othniel as it is about Oxa. The importance of women in the operation of taking the land for God, for God's purposes. How important to one's life is one's wife? And you know, this is part of the question, the main question that this book asks about women all throughout. The question of this book regarding women is, are they treasured or are they disregarded? Are they disregarded as Jephthah does in chapter 11 with his daughter and his grotesque vow when you get to chapter 11? Are they denigrated like the Levite concubine in chapter 19 when you get to that story? Or are they treasured like Oxa in chapter 1? The gendered marriage provides a way to treasure women. And regardless, single or married, they are to be treasured in the covenant community for their role in taking the land, for their part in the operation of building the kingdom of God on earth. It's the message. So lastly, friends, before we come to our table this morning, I want to give you the main reason why gendered marriage is so powerful a thing, why it does seem to create these stabilities in marriage, is why it creates intimacy in marriage. And the answer can be seen in verse 7, kind of indirectly, by looking at the counterfeit that the Israelites go after instead of worshiping the living God. In verse 7, it says that the Israelites did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God. They served the Baals and the Asherahs. The Baals and the Asherahs. Now, for a long time, that was a puzzle to people reading the Bible, is what an Asherah was. But Ugaritic evidence from the last century, really, that's been unearthed in the last century, has shown us pretty clearly that the Asherah was a goddess, kind of a prominent goddess in Canaanite mythology. Sometimes she's the wife of the god El. Sometimes she's, as here, she's the consort of Baal. Because there were these kind of different altars, monuments that were set up together, Baals and Asherahs. You go up and they, you know, you get the Baal thing and you get the Asherah thing. And this is what Israel thought. Israel thought this was the way to stability in their lives and in their marriages, is to go after this kind of fertility religions, which involved a god and goddess kind of having some kind of physical relationship. So you see, this is the counterfeit that the Israelites went after, a god and goddess, instead of the living God who has both genders is in his self. God contains the masculine and the feminine within him. So when he created this two-flavored image of him. Why was the marriage of Oxa and Othniel so powerful? Because these things, friends, come out of the very being of God. The love within God's very self. The most powerful thing that's ever been done on earth is the accomplishment of salvation for people. And that was accomplished through what God, the love that God has within God's very own triune self. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the Apostle Paul kind of draws a parallel. He says, you know, this dynamic that you see in a husband and wife, it comes from the dynamic within the triune Godhead. Because as the husband is the head of the wife, so God the Father is the head of the second member of the Trinity, of the Son. So he draws a parallel here. And we can see that when we actually look at what Christ did to God, when we see the life of Christ on the earth. In a way, we could say Jesus gave to God the Father as the feminine to him. Christ is the feminine to God the Father. And he is the motivation, Christ is the motivation of God to accomplish the plan of salvation in bringing his kingdom to earth. There are statements that tell us in the scriptures that God the Father did that, is doing that, to lift up Christ, to exalt Christ. In other words, Christ is the motivation for the plan of salvation. You can see it in the way that Jesus pressed the Father. Whereas the Christ pressed God the Father for his inheritance. And you know what his inheritance was? You. You are Christ's inheritance. You could tell the way that Jesus prayed, when he prayed, "Give me the people." He's praying, pressing on God to give him the inheritance. At the end of his ministry, he says, "I haven't lost any of the ones that you've given me." But mostly, we see this acted out in the way that Christ came to create. Christ is building a home for God on earth. That's what Christ is doing, and that's what he did when he came. He was on the ground, so he saw practically what needed to happen and started making it work. He found a way to make it work so that that God could actually find residence on the earth. There could be a home. The way Christ was making a home for God on earth so that the earth could become God's footstool. These are the ways Christ is the feminine to the Father. And this is what accomplished the mighty deed of salvation, your salvation, their love for one another. Amen. Amen. Will you please stand?